Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Alice Tolakowski.
This week,
Julia Gillard versus The Oz.
It may not be glamorous, but Tontine's date-stamped pillows win more awards.
Red and black faces at the Flying Kangaroo.
Droga 5's big win.
The Chasers' war on the media.
With us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance's Jonty Est.
Hello there.
And Jonty, welcome back to the podcast. Now, busy time over at the Alliance with the Walkley's deadline fast approaching.
Walkley's deadline is tomorrow at 5 p.m. actually, so get your entries in.
Yes, by the time the podcast goes up, we're recording this on a Thursday, it'll be Friday. So what time on Friday is the deadline?
5 p.m.
5 p.m.
Absolutely, get your entries
hours
in.
Remaining. Yeah. But is it one of these ones that people ring up and say, "Oh, can I have a loon extension, please?"
Look, I think if there's an exceptional circumstance involved, and you know that exceptional being you might be a journalist and not very good at hitting deadlines, which you know obviously you ought to be. But no, we really want people to get them in by tomorrow at 5. But
give you a ring if maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely, yeah. The main thing is that we get the best journalism in Australia for the awards.
Now, not everyone listening is a journalist. They may, you know, they'll probably have heard of the Walkleys, but not have a sense. So open for all types of journalism, not just print journalism.
That's right, absolutely. Across all platforms. In fact, we're really expanding our online categories. We're really keen to recognise that more and more people are working in online across all platforms. There are now award categories that recognise continuous coverage of an issue, which obviously is something that online does extremely well. There is best online journalism, so that's a sort of side of things I can only see expanding over the years to come. This year, very excitingly, we are launching the new category for best documentary, so the Walkley Award for the best documentary.
Yeah, that was an interesting one when you announced that, because it's sort of one of those ones I almost assumed that it would have existed already.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think this recognises again that more and more journalists are looking at new ways in telling their stories, and I think the documentary format is proving to be very popular. It's something journalists are obviously very good at, making documentaries. They're very popular. You can consume them, you can watch them on TV, you go to the cinema. I mean, I think the best thing I've seen at the cinema in Yonks was the Inside Job, which is about the global financial crisis, which is fabulous. And Australians make great documentaries. You can watch them online. So, you know, it's a perfect fit for us. So we're mad keen on that. And the finalists will be shown in the week running up to the Walkley Awards, which is the Walkley Awards night is the Sunday, the 27th of November, and that's in Brisbane this year. And we're having a Walkley's week, which is going to be terribly exciting. And during that week, we're going to show the three finalists and then obviously announce who the winner is on the Sunday night at the gala, black tie, all singing, all dancing, Walkley's dinner.
And what we'll talk about the week a bit more in a moment. With the dinner, and this is a time where all the journalists kind of come together in the room, and this has been a bad year for the ABC with having lost several journalists, for instance. Yeah. Is that the sort of thing you try and reflect on the night, kind of acknowledge that sort of thing when it's happened?
Yeah, look, I think so. I mean, it was a tragic sort of couple of weeks for the ABC, but for journalism as well. Mm. You know, they lost some fantastic, very experienced and excellent people.
And how do you hit the tone of that sort of thing on the night? Because obviously there are a lot of people, drinks being had, it's a noisy room, and it's sometimes quite hard to actually be respectful in that sort of environment.
Well, I think what we do is, one of the things we do every year is do a bit of a year in review package, and as part of that, we can handle that very sensitively. And then, once you have done this, generally, you can hear a pin drop in the room. I can remember when Matt Price passed away, three years ago or something like that.
Maybe again, not
this
even
was,
that long,
was reflected
yeah.
in on the night, and obviously it was very moving. But at the same time, you then recognise this is a celebration of great journalism. I think one thing that we saw after the terrible helicopter tragedy was the sort of outpouring of emotion and respect for the. There's a lot of respect, not just among journalists, but in the community. And I think, at the awards dinner, we reflect on that. But we also celebrate their lives and work as part of a celebration of journalism.
Mm-hmm. And my first, having been in the country at 5 years, pretty much my first memory of journalism in Australia was I'd been in the country for maybe a week and turning on the television and watching this thing called the Walkley Awards, and it had already started. And somebody was just halfway through an announcement when somebody else marched onto the stage and fisticuffs erupted. Yes. Of course, Glenn Milne and...
Fabulous. Milne Main.
Yes.
Bout.
Yeah, Stephen Main, who kind of sort of jumped off the stage. Is there a kind of a history of tensions boiling up a little bit at the Walkley?
Look, sometimes that might happen. You get a room full of journalists, add alcohol, add rivalry, and you will probably get a bit of the odd argument being progressed.
And are you guys strategic with the seating plan? Do you deliberately like put all of the Fairfax people over one side of the room and or the opposite? Do you actually put them together to make it more interesting?
Look, I'm not sure actually. That's not something I'm too involved in. I think probably there are strategic table placings. Seriously, sponsors, people who've taken tables as part of a sponsorship deal will get sponsors
up the front.
Up the front, yeah, obviously.
And it's always that thing that, you know, somebody walks in and if they're sat at the back, they know they're not going to win anything. I know people are always told, oh, well, you know, of course you have a chance from the back, but, you know, you're not going to win anything.
Look, I don't think it's going to be like the sort of notorious What the Papers Say Awards in Britain, where there pretty much is a fight every year, although perhaps without News of the World table this year, there might be slightly less shenanigans, but... But you know, obviously, everybody's up. They want to win an award. You know, you're going to get friendly disputes. Let's say, perhaps.
So the conference itself, also taking part in Brisbane in the build up to the awards. Yeah. What are the key elements of that this year?
We're very excited about the conference. It's going to take place. We kind of split it over 3 days. So it starts on Friday the 25th and continues with a full day. We've got an afternoon on the Friday, we've got a full day on the Saturday, and then a morning on the Sunday, and then obviously the Walkley Awards on the Sunday night. And the thing really kicks off on the Friday with a pretty high level panel, which we're still, I'll have some announcements to make about some of the people we've got on it. But what we want to talk about is entrepreneurial journalism, and we're very lucky to have secured, very excited to have got John Bracken, who's. He's an American chap. He's the bloke that runs the Knight Foundation's grant. So every year he hands out $5 million to good ideas that are being developed in the States to try and... So every block, for example, the hyperlocal journalism project was developed with a grant from the Knight Foundation. And he's going to come over here and talk about innovation and entrepreneurial journalism. So the first panel we've got, he's going to be sitting on, it's about entrepreneurial journalism, and... We're hoping that we'll have a certain T. Burrows taking part on
if
that.
I can play a very small role, then I'll be very happy to do so.
Just because, for my money, one of the key things journalists want to hear about is how do you go about starting up an idea? If you've got a good idea, how do you go about making it work? And what we want to do is get a mix of people that have done that, and then someone like John Bracken who can talk about, you know, the best ways of going about getting funding and that kind of thing. So that's on the Friday. We also have the Walkley Centenary Lecture. It's the 100th year of the Journalist Union this year, so we've been celebrating that all year. And so we're going to have a very special guest, and I'm hoping to be able to make an announcement about that in the next couple of weeks. We'll deliver a lecture about the state of journalism and the future of the industry.
And this special guest, without giving too much away, this is someone from Australia or
yes,
someone from...
Yes, it'll be a major player from Australia.
Right,
so
okay.
we're just kind of talking,
Rupert
finalising
Murdoch.
That. He's not in us. He's now in America, so he unfortunately, and I think... He might be a little bit too humble.
Someone
for
a current practitioner?
There'll be a current practitioner, yeah.
John Hardigan.
Well, as I said, I'm hoping to have an announcement to make in the next couple of weeks. The next day, you know, the focus of this whole conference is to move between the theoretical and the practical, if you like. So we're going to have plenary sessions in which we talk about what's going on in the industry, and have people blue sky thinking about what's likely to happen. And then in our breakout room, we're going to be featuring a full day of hour long media labs in which we're going to hopefully get experts to impart some actual practical skills, so how to edit video for online, how to record podcasts, how to interview for podcasts. Because if you're anything like me and you're a print journalist, you're probably really lousy at actually doing radio interviews. I know I am, so I'm actually going to go to that myself, hopefully, and pick up some tips.
I think I'd better as well.
and then on the Sunday, we have in a sense it's the key panel session, and we're lining up some hopefully some really good people for this. And it's actually, it's the sort of really blue sky panel, which is about super fast broadband, you know, which is the NBN by any other name. What's it going to do to the industry? I mean, clearly we all think it's going to have a profound effect on the way people consume and produce journalism content. And so we're hoping to line up some of the sort of top players to actually give us some of their thoughts about what the industry might look like once everybody's got whiz-bang super-fast broadband to the fingertips. And that's one I think will be, particularly because it's on the same day as the Walkies, I think there'll be a lot of people coming up. So we're hoping we'll get a real full house and a really lively discussion. That's one I'm really looking forward to.
A couple of other sort of journalism stories have been coming up this week. The ABC's programme on News of the World and hacking.
Wasn't it fabulous?
Yeah, what did you think? Because on the one hand, it was well put together, but on the other hand, I'm not sure I learned anything new.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you're anything like me, I've kind of been eating and drinking this story for the best part of a year now, actually. So a lot of that stuff... I felt like I knew most of that stuff. However, what I loved about it was that for the first time in Vision, you saw quite how kind of some of the grubby operators that were being employed by tabloid newspapers in Britain, some of the very kind of I don't know what the best
not
way
very to, nice yes, people
not very nice people getting involved in this, and there was stuff that hasn't come out yet, which I think probably will, but there was hinted at some of the... So this bloke, is it Jonathan Rees, this private detective? Mm. You know, the fact that he was sort of taken on again
after
coming out of prison for what was it? He planted cocaine.
Yeah, he was trying to frame somebody, wasn't he?
I mean, that really is miserable stuff, isn't it?
Yes. And we should probably be clear, the piece he went to prison for wasn't related to the news of the world.
No, that's right.
It was the fact they employed him afterwards.
Sounds like he was a bit of a sort of scumbag for hire. I don't know if that's defamatory, but
I don't think he has a reputation to defend.
No,
really,
I know,
he,
and you kind of looked at that and you thought, God, you know, and let me say, I worked for News Limited in Australia for best part of 15 very happy years, and you know, I saw no evidence that sort of stuff was going on here, no evidence of those sorts of people, and I'd be, you know, obviously there's an inquiry going to happen, or there's an internal inquiry underway at News Limited at the moment, and I think it's being overseen by a couple of Victorian High Court judges are going to be the sort of arbiters. I know that Julian Disney's been involved in setting that up, and obviously we'll be very interested to find out what that discovers. But you know, at the moment, as far as we're concerned, you know, we haven't seen any sign of that sort of stuff happening at News Limited in Australia, and I think we have to take John Hartigan's word at the moment that that's the situation.
Well, a bit later on, we'll chat about the Australian a little bit more.
Yeah.
The other sort of journalistic story of the last week or two was inevitably became called Choppergate.
Yes.
The faking of live crosses by Nine in Brisbane. And we've talked about this on the podcast before. Now, one of the things about this story is everything about TV is artificial.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that whether a live cross took place to the helicopter and the helipad, or whether it was circling Nine, or whether it was actually, you know, near the murder search scene. Is this a ethical grey area, or is it actually black and white and it was black?
Look, I think it's pretty black and white, actually. You know, journalism, to a very large extent, depends on the trust that exists between the journalist and the audience, and that was it's a betrayal of that trust, frankly. And the funny thing is, I think we all know that live crosses often, you live cross to someone who says yes, and there's nothing happening. And what are you going to see from a chopper in the air at night? You know, so look, I mean, I don't know what it would have cost them to say, look, we've been trying to get a chopper into the air, but you know, the conditions are wrong, we can't do it. You know, we'll bring you back if there's any update. But to fake it, and you've got to, you know, I guess you've got to feel for the young journos involved, being put under pressure to do this sort of stuff.
And I think there's another alternative version, because you know, the narrative so far is the journalist and the chopper being put under pressure by the producers. The other alternative version, of course, we don't know which one is correct, is that the producers was unaware. It were, and this is kind of me theorising, but have been helped to theorise,
yeah,
is that it was in the evening, it was the end of the weekend. It's a lot nicer to be doing the live cross from quite close to base, so you can be home 20 minutes earlier than if you're hovering above the site. So, so I guess what we don't know is, were the producers aware on the ground of what was going on and where their chopper was, versus were the guys in the air, unaware that the caption was saying near the murder scene. So you know, and I guess this is the problem: is it, it trust between individual journalists or trust of an organisation that allows a number of cock-ups to happen for that to go to air?
Look, I think there's certainly an element of that. Now, I don't know the truth of this. I, you know, obviously it's something you talk about in the pub, and someone said to me that the reporter had actually said something towards the end of his the live cross that essentially gave the impression that said, we're not in the air, or we're not in the area. I don't know. I didn't hear that. But look, I think one very important point needs to be made, and that is that journalists work to the Alliance Code of Ethics. Australian journalists work to that code, whether they're members or not. Really, pretty much every newsroom accepts that the Alliance Code of Ethics is the core set of values by which we work. I think it's I forget which point it is, but there is a clause in that which says that journalists must resist pressure to behave unethically, and if in doubt, if you think you're being forced to do something that you think is dodgy ethically, then you should ring the union and check it out, because again, the integrity is at the very, very heart of what we do as journalists, and if you and once that trust, once that is breached, then we lose respect in the community, and God knows that's something we can't afford to do right now.
Do many journalists take advantage of that?
Yeah, some people do. I mean, look, I did once. I said to my chief of staff it was a death knock, which I thought was the wrong thing to do. And I said, in the end, because I said I'm uncomfortable about doing this. I think it's intrusive. I really don't think we should do this. And they wanted me to do it. And in the end, I took the code of ethics out and said, look, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it. You'll have to find, you know, if you want to go through this, and I don't think you should, you'll have to find someone else. But I'm going to invoke the code.
And do you think it hurt your standing in the newsroom?
Don't know. I can't answer that one. It shouldn't do, really. I mean, because I think, you know, once again, a sound sense of what is ethical and what isn't, and what's invading privacy and what isn't, is so important. And never more than now.
Mm. Next, Gillard versus The Australian.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all of these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. So the Australian newspaper this week ended up in a confrontation with Julia Gillard after columnist Glenn Milne revealed details about a story he worked on 4 years ago involving the PM. On Monday, the Australian pulled the article from the website, which included details, quote, the lawyers would not allow to be reported, unquote, at the time Milne wrote the story. The article, headed PM, a lost cause for warring unions, then went on to make an allegation regarding her former personal life. Tim, what do you think is going to come of this?
Yes, firstly, it's obviously Glenn Milne week, the fact that we're talking about him again after his action at the Walkleys. This was kind of an odd one because, you know, this allegation was contained in an opinion piece rather than a front page news story. So I think if the... It smacks to me of cock-up rather than conspiracy, because I think if The Australian felt they had revelations they could now report for the first time, they'd have stuck them on the front page and gone big on it. So that's almost the first point is, you know, and I saw in Crikey described as, you know, Milne going rogue and then Bolt going rogue as well, and we'll get onto that in a minute as well. But you know, it looks like something that slipped through over the weekend. You know, I suspect that a sub somewhere has been severely bollocked for letting it through. What seems to have emerged since is that these allegations, which certainly it looks as if there's not a great deal of basis for them, and some of this is reading from reporting elsewhere, had created some sort of level of alertness from Gillard and her people, who, it's been said, you know, made phone calls right to the top of News Limited, John Hardigan, perhaps, who had talked to, certainly according to Andrew Bolt, who's another News Limited columnist, had Hardigan had talked to the tabloids within the group and was able to assure Gillard that none of this was going to be reported, hadn't talked to the Australian, though, and then suddenly this popped up, which probably explains why, you know, when Gillard went nuclear, it came down again. Whether that truly means that they withdraw the allegation, which they did in the apology, or whether it was a cautious thing because this was a fast-moving story and people were angry and assurances have been given, not quite sure. But then the kind of spin-off from this as well was Andrew Bolt, who, you know, is a pretty outspoken columnist, you know, for all of the News Limited tabloids, felt that he was having his hands tied and then revealed in his column that he was thinking of resigning over it. So it's one of those ones, probably entirely unwelcome, and particularly in the wider context for News Limited, as Jonty was saying. There's currently the questions around whether there'll be an inquiry into the media by the government or by Parliament. It's kind of the last thing that the media or News Limited needs to blow up just now.
Absolutely, Jonathan. You worked for the Australian. You wrote for them. From your experience, how do you think they'd be dealing with this kind of thing right now, especially considering all the other stuff that's going around surrounding the media at the moment?
Yeah, look, I don't know how morale is inside Holt Street at the moment. I think they've circled the wagons a little bit. I've spoken to a number of people over this week, and you know, reactions have been mixed. Although one of my friends, sort of his reaction was, or virtually the first thing he said to me when I spoke to him was, you know, so we can't criticise the Prime Minister anymore. You know, and I was astonished that, by what I can understand, that this piece wasn't legaled, or it doesn't appear to have been legaled, because you'd have thought that if it couldn't be done 4 years ago and no new evidence had emerged, then surely it can't be done now. So, but like you said, I think it couldn't have come at a worse time. If there was any equivocation about the appetite for an inquiry within the government ranks, I don't suppose there is now. I think they're quite keen to have some kind of inquiry. And look, what we think of the Alliance is that the inquiry, you know, and there's been all this thing, should it be an inquiry into bias, should it be an inquiry into ethics? And there's a lot of code for Let's Get News Limited, which I think would be isn't a particularly practical thing to be looking at the moment, given the state of the news media in Australia. We support the idea of an inquiry, but we support the idea of something which would be similar to inquiries they've had in the UK and the US, congressional inquiry and a parliamentary inquiry actually into the health of the news industry. I think that's long overdue in Australia. We need to get the community as a whole talking about how are we as an industry going to survive the challenges that are being thrown at us, because you look at the share price graphs of the media companies, they're not healthy. We're staring down the barrel of you know, more job losses in journalists, actually newspaper closures. There's a lot of people kind of, you know, beginning to talk in terms of, will News Limited divest itself of its papers in Australia? That's, you know, that's not something, you know, that's something a lot of people have canvassed. And that would, you know, we need to now, as a community, sit down and talk about what can we do to promote the health of journalism and the news industry in Australia. I think getting too tied up in who did what to whom, ethics, bias. But, you know, bias is such a loaded word anyway. I don't know how you would have an inquiry about perceived bias in the news industry, because, you know, that then drags in, you know, the ABC and it becomes a sort of circular slanging match. And I think that's the very last thing anyone really wants. I think what we want is a constructive discussion of where the industry is going, how to ensure it survives, and how to ensure it flourishes, both private sector and public broadcasting.
Next, happy soldiers and fresh pillows at the Effies.
Defunct ad agency Happy Soldiers received top honours at the Effie Awards last week, taking home the Grand Effie for client Tontine. Now, the pillow brand was the first to put use-by dates on their pillows, which increased sales by 345% in the week of the launch. But the independent Sydney ad agency closed its doors in April because its three managing partners disagreed about its future direction. Other winners at the Effies included Clem's Melbourne, Clemenger BBDO Melbourne, who were named Effective Agency of the Year, and UM, the only media agency to win, for their work on Unilever's Streets Magnum brand. Probably worth mentioning that the Tontine campaign also did well in Cannes as well. Now, Cannes obviously mainly a creative festival, the Effie's effectiveness. Alice, the key differences between a creative campaign and an effective campaign.
An effectiveness award. If you're Tontine looking at a 345% increase in sales after that campaign, you've got to, you know, be pretty happy with seeing them, your agency that are doing your work, getting an effectiveness award. It sends a pretty good message to clients. Creative awards do send that same similar message, but they are peer judged. You know, that to win a creative award over a fellow ad agency is a little bit more peer driven, I guess.
And I suppose that it comes down to results in the end as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually saw in Cannes this year there was a new category for creative effectiveness, which was won by Walker's Chips.
This is in the UK.
Yeah, or crisps.
We call them crisps in the UK.
Sorry. But and they
this
had
this is for sandwich.
Yeah, it was. And they had basically Jenson Button going around driving a cab. And
Jenson Button, for those who don't follow Formula One.
Yes, for those who don't follow Formula One, Jenson Button is a British driver, and he was driving around the town of Sandwich, basically saying that any sandwich is more exciting with Walkers, and it was a very good campaign.
And they transformed the whole of Sandwich. So, you know, the person taking the local sort of, you know, the local football team training was a, you know, well-known British footballer, and so there were all of these stunts all around the town of Sandwich. So that won the creative award the previous year at Cannes, and then they came back and proved that actually it shifted more units as well. Going back to the Tontine campaign, Jonty, one of the things I really liked about this campaign and it impressed me right from the beginning was it wasn't just an advertising campaign. There was PR involved as well. There was media involved as well. So they also kind of created this, you know, loads of news stories around the fact that you've got all of these bugs and mites in your pillow, you know, from dead skin. So up on, you know, the night the campaign began, today, tonight, there's a story about it. What do you make of that kind of relation between, you know, with journalism as part of a marketing campaign?
Can I just say at the outset that I recently rediscovered the joys of having chips in a sandwich. And
you said chips for the record.
Ham sandwich, that's crisps, but it's in England, chips in Australia. Ham sandwich, bag of crisps.
Adds
in the
texture,
sandwich.
Doesn't it?
Adds texture, it's fantastic. Now, excuse me, as to Tontine and the scientific basis on which pillows have a use-by date, I think, quite often, I'm not going to comment about the scientific worth or otherwise of these cod science items on programmes like Today Tonight. They make for entertaining viewing at the time, and they make give Jonathan Holmes something to have a bit of a laugh about on Media Watch.
And The Chaser soon as well with their new show.
And
yes.
The Chaser, exactly. I don't think you'd want to get too excited about. I think the idea of a pillow having a use by date is kind of fabulous, but it's not going to actually have me throwing pillows out every couple of years. Maybe I should. We'll have to look that one up. I'm sure if you Google it, you're going to find all sorts of factual basis for the amount of dust mites and whatever else that we have in our heads. But the trouble is, again, it goes down to, you know, it's this quality argument, isn't it? If you're telling people, if you feed people stuff which is really not believable, then you start to, it's the person that cried wolf, doesn't it? You start not to believe any journalism, and I think that's a problem for us.
Next, red and black faces at the Flying Kangaroo.
For those who don't know, Australia won the Bledisloe Cup on the weekend. And for those who don't know what the Bledisloe Cup is, it's a rugby union tournament. In relevant news, Qantas ran a competition prior to the match where they were giving away two tickets to the game. Fans were asked to tweet what they would do to win tickets. Two fans said they would dress as Radiki Samo, a Fijian-born Wallaby rugby player. The fans were snapped at the match wearing black afro wigs and they had their faces painted black. The airline's social media team posted a photo of the winners at the game, which received quite the backlash. They've since apologised, and Samo has said he wasn't offended by the impression. Tim, it's taken a lot more seriously in the US than it is here. We've seen quite a few examples here. Do you think it's that influence that's offending people in Australia?
Yeah, I suspect some of this is genuine cultural differences. You know, we had it with the Hey Hey reunion where they had the guys in blackface as the tribute to Michael Jackson. And I suspect some of it is here in Australia, there isn't the offensive history around blackface, which there has been in the, you know, with minstrel shows in the US, in the UK. But the issue for Qantas, obviously, is it's a global brand and a global company, and that sort of image travels around the world. So, you know, there are plenty of people who sort of made the point, well, look, you know, these are fans who are paying tribute to their favourite player. Players come out and said he was very flattered by the whole thing, had no problem with it. I suppose as a marketing issue, though, it's the fact that the brand would be comfortable tweeting their image from its own account, you know, regardless of whether Australians would be offended or not. You know, not having that bigger picture of the fact that, you know, Twitter's kind of global. You know, that image is going to, you know, run a lot bigger in the US than it is over here.
Yeah. Jonathan, offensive or no harm caused?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Hey Hey Saturday Red Faces thing, I think, had it not been for, was it Robert Downey Jr.? Was
no, it was Chris Harry... Isaac.
No, it wasn't. No, it was another junior, Harry Connick Jr.
Oh, was
yeah,
it?
If it hadn't
oh,
been.
We got there in the end.
Oh, yeah.
I suspect, and in fact, I think I'm right in saying a couple of the other panellists had sort of given them decent marks, and then Harry Connick Jr. said how horrified he was, and you kind of saw this great about face, and suddenly everybody else started to be horrified too.
Yes, I think he said to them, hey, if this was America, it would be Hey Hey, No More Show.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Look, it's funny, I just reviewed Nick Bryant's book about his memoir of the BBC correspondent.
Oh, this is Adventures in Correspondent Land.
And one of the things the second last chapter is about his time in Australia, and one of the things he says he was quite sort of taken aback by was the level of casual racism in Australia, and he pointed to that incident, the Hey Hey incident, as being an example of that. Look, it's difficult, isn't it? Because the rugby player said he was actually chuffed that you know, he felt it was a tribute. There was no offence meant at all. I don't know because I know that in America there is this history of and people do take great offence and like you say, Qantas is a global brand. I would have thought that Qantas would have thought, you know, after the whole Hey Hey thing last year, maybe would have thought twice about that. I don't know I think it's very easy to spot racism where it's not meant intended. Look, I don't want to make a judgment on that. I certainly wouldn't be blacking my face up and appearing on, you know, in public or on the internet, I don't think. But at the same time, you know, I'm going to be interested to see how that whole conversation develops. And I'm going back to Europe, and I might see what people think about it back there, because I think we have a different take in Australia. Qantas has really got to, you know, has got to kind of count the cost of the fact that it does need to sell its brand worldwide, and it's going to have offended people in the States and perhaps in Europe. I don't know. Inadvertent mistake, perhaps, rather than you know, reflecting any kind of racism, I think, probably.
It was a bit like the KFC one a while back, where, you know, there was the question over the... It was the association with black people with fried chicken,
fried
wasn't
chicken,
it?
Fried chicken, yeah. They were eating... The fans were eating a bucket of chicken, I think, and
yeah.
Someone... I think an Indian person gave the bucket of chicken. I can't remember the exact
details.
Yeah,
it was along those lines. But
yeah.
Again, it was this thing that, you know, in the US, there's this cliche around black people eat fried chicken, yeah. which again isn't really a cliche that exists in Australia. So it was just, I think the message was given, you know, sort of home fans and away fans. Someone wanted to steal their KFC snack,
yeah.
But again, once it had the global audience, it caused great offence.
But then, you know. When in MasterChef, I think when they went to New York, one of the things was they went to Sylvia's, I think it is, in Harlem, which I've been to and had lunch there myself, and it's fabulous. But there's a big sort of shtick going on with fried chicken and collard greens, and it's very kind of it's all about that kind of almost stereotyping, which they use it to sell very successfully several generations worth of good food, you know, and that's a family that's branded themselves like that. So I think, you know, hey, it's difficult to then turn around when someone else uses that and say, well, you can't do that, you know.
Well, next, Droga5 picks up craft.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Ad agency Droga5 has been added to the craft roster, assigned to look after Cadbury brands including Boost, Cherry Ripe and Picnic. Now, at the same time, GPY&R and the Ross partnership have been dropped. Earlier, I chatted to Mumbrella deputy editor Robin Hicks about this back at Mumbrella House when the news broke.
So, Robin, you've been working on the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. You know better than most at the moment the ups and downs of Sydney and Melbourne's various agencies. How big a deal do you think for Droga5 is it getting onto the craft roster?
Well, Droga5 gave themselves what I thought was a rather generous 8 out of 10 for their performance this year. And indeed, I think some of our expert panel would also see that as giving themselves a higher mark than they deserve. That's until that they won craft. I think this, for an agency that is often accused of being a bit of smoke and mirrors, this certainly adds some substance to their client roster. But what does the craft decision say about the rest of the agencies on their roster? I think it's very harsh on GPY&R, which has been having a really tough time of it of late. Their Picnic work won a Gold Lion at Cannes for the It's No Picnic campaign. And also their Boost Study Buddy campaign was very well received. So great news for Droga, but harsh on GPY&R.
And I guess for GPY&R, it's worth differentiating between, it almost feels to me anyway, that most of GPY&R's woes are in Sydney rather than Melbourne. So it's been unusual for the Melbourne branch to actually lose a piece of business.
Yeah, agreed. They're an excellent agency with a really good track record. And GPY&R is a strange agency in Australia, I think, where the difference between the Sydney and Melbourne offices, the golfing class, is very, very great, perhaps bigger than any other agency brand in Australia. So, yeah, for the Melbourne office to take this, it's quite a heavy blow for them.
Next, the Chaser's war on media.
Be warned. The Chaser has announced its next target, and it's the media. It was announced on Wednesday that the new show, The Hamster Wheel, will consist of 8 half-hour shows analysing news. Meanwhile, we saw the return of a couple of shows over the last week. The X Factor on 7 has been averaging the mid to high 1 millions. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it all was the top voted top show. But unfortunately for Top Gear Australia on 9, its returns are a dismal 503,000 viewers. 9 has also dropped medieval series Camelot after one double episode. The first one at 9:40 aired after Underbelly Razor and received 640,000, and the second one a much lower 294,000. Tim, you've got a theory behind Top Gear Australia. What do you think is happening there?
Well, yeah, I mean, Top Gear Australia, so this is licensed from BBC Worldwide, the Top Gear brand. So obviously there's the UK version, which Nine snatched from the hands of SBS, basically. Now, my understanding is that part of the deal is that you also have to create a local version of the franchise in a certain number of episodes. Now, to begin with, Top Gear was a really good franchise for Nine and was getting good numbers, and they've dramatically declined over the last year or so. In part, I think, because of the way it's been promoted, it's a mixture of new episodes and old episodes and very, very high ad content. So, a show which is supplied at about 50 minutes to fit an hour of commercial TV in some markets has been stretched over about 90 minutes here in Australia. So that's really annoyed the fans. Also, sometimes there's been a fair delay between when it's been broadcast and when it's gone out. So again, people are real, mad keen fans may use illegal downloading to watch it that way. So gradually the kind of franchise has sort of fallen away anyway. So it strikes me that this time around, Nine have they fulfilled their minimum obligation to do the local show. I didn't see any promotion at all for Top Gear Australia, which suggests that they didn't, perhaps they didn't really believe in it, either that or it was brilliantly, brilliantly targeted at Top Gear fans only, and I just didn't see it for that reason. But certainly, the ratings suggest that, if they had put some marketing behind it, then I'm sure it would have done better, you know, at least for people coming in and sampling, you know, about, as you say, about half of what it did last time around. So it feels to me like, Nine was going through the motions with the local thing, didn't really particularly believe in it. To me, and this is just a theory, you know, it smacks to me that, you know, when however long the deal is for Nine to have Top Gear, they're not going to renew it.
Yeah, they also, I saw that they were featuring one, if not both, of Hamish and Andy, which obviously was a bit of a cross promotion with Hamish and Andy's gap year, which has kind of started off well, but that's kind of fallen away a little bit there.
It has, yeah. It's dropped below a million. But that said, I mean, I think that's a good show, and it's probably delivering a really strong demographic that Nine would want for the audiences. So I wouldn't just judge Hamish and Andy just by the top line numbers. You know, looking at the demographic, that younger male audience, which is what they apply, you know, what they like to attract, they're probably still doing pretty well there on. So, you know, I think Nine would probably count Hamish and Andy still as a success. Mm. But and obviously they, you know, because people love them, they use them to cross promote the other stuff.
Yeah. Jonathan, obviously we're seeing quite a success with Underbelly Razor so far for Nine, but there doesn't, you know, really seem to be much else really happening for them. Do you think Crisis Talks are in order there?
Yeah,
with them?
I do wonder, actually. I watched Underbelly Razor with great enthusiasm because I've read the book by the wonderfully named Larry Reiter and loved it, and I thought I was really looking forward to that, and I thought the first double episode was great, was really, you know, loved it, returned to form, because I thought that format had slipped a bit with the third Underbelly series, the one set in King's Cross. The second one, I just found it's more of a struggle to actually care so much. And, you know, as you see, a lot of Nine shows have are really kind of suffering. And I don't know about Crisis Talks, but certainly they're going to have to look at their formulas. What was Camelot another Nine?
Yes, that came and went. Did you watch it?
No, I didn't. I sort of meant to, actually, but then life got in the way. But was this something that was like a series of a certain number of episodes, like Game of Thrones has been, or is it just an ongoing series where you can watch it each week?
My sense is that they will probably still run the other episodes on Go or Gem. I'm sure it'll pop up somewhere else. But certainly I found out I was actually in the office on Sunday night, so I had it on in the background, Underbelly on in the background. Mm. But the thing was, every time I turned around, you know, it was certainly a lot raunchier than Merlin, that was for sure.
Well, that's the formula, isn't it? And so, again, Game of Thrones is one of these, is another one which is...
It's running on Showcase at the moment.
Showcase, that's right. And that's that isn't really what you'd call a particularly family-oriented show. It's fantastic, by the way. And I wonder if... Is Camelot very similar? Lots of violence, lots of glossy sex, that kind of stuff? I presume so.
I certainly noticed the glossy sex.
I'm a big fan of the Arthurian legend.
Oh,
absolutely, yeah, that too. But,
what I have found is it's perfect, because where I sit in the office, my back is to the television, but I've discovered that if I prop my iPad up at the right angle and turn it off, it acts as a little mirror, so I can be working away and use the iPad as a mirror. So is there nothing this device cannot do?
It's fabulous, isn't it? No, look, I think it's a shame about Camelot, because I think, you know, it's such a great story, and I will try and make a point of watching some of it, because I think it, you know, I've been in love with the Arthurian legend since I was a kid, you know, and there's loads of opportunity for lots of swashbuckling, lots of sort of bed action and all that kind of stuff. That's what the story's all about, you know. So what a shame it doesn't seem to have translated into ratings for, you know, but hey, hopefully they'll show the rest of it.
And briefly, we should talk about the hamster wheel. We mentioned it earlier. This is quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this, actually. It's I mean, The Chaser has basically, that's essentially been what they've done, isn't it?
It is. I would say at least half of it was about media
anyway.
It's
always been
wasn't
like
it?
That, yeah. And you know, you read a lot over the last few years about how, for example, in the States, you know, most people under the age of about kind of 30 get their news from Jon Stewart, you know, and that sort of satirical spin on the news. Look, I mean, you know, there are two ways of looking at this. One is that actually, wouldn't it be great if people just read the news or watched the news because they were interested in issues, and we didn't have to sugarcoat it with sort of gags and skits to make it interesting. But look, if it brings people into appreciate issues and journalism, then that's great. And looking at Jon Stewart, he's got a lot of trust in among younger people. I would imagine The Chase has got a similar kind of profile here in its demographic. You know, I can take or leave The Chase. They've been very good to us at the Walkley Foundation. They've always done a lot of stuff to help us, and you know, they've got, we've got a lot of time for them. as far as the shows go, you know, as I say, I can take or leave them. Some of them are hysterical. Sometimes I think, oh, you know, maybe a bit undergraduate kind of thing. But look, I'll be interested to see it because, you know, when you're in the journalism business, you spend your life being very pointy-headed about news, and it's great, actually, sometimes to just have a jolly good, you know, sit and have a giggle about something. So good luck to them.
Tim, do we have an air date for that yet?
We don't. No, they haven't announced an air date yet. They're just going into pre-production now, so it's not imminent. But you know, certainly this side of Christmas, I'm sure. That is all we have time for today. A big thank you to John T. Est.
Thank you very much.
And to Alice Telikovsky.
Thank you both.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.